Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke. This coming Monday, October 25th, Scottish actor, singer, writer, filmmaker, activist, and Tony, Olivier, BAFTA, and Emmy Award winner Alan Cumming will be in conversation with my colleague, Joe Donahue, at the Bardavon in Poughkeepsie, New York. Cumming has written a new memoir entitled Baggage, Tales from a Fully Packed Life, which will be released by Day Street Books on Tuesday. Cumming's London stage appearances include Hamlet, The Maniac and Accidental Death of an Anarchist, the lead in Bent, Dionysus, and the National Theatre of Scotland's The Bacchae. On Broadway, he's appeared in the Threepenny Opera, twice as the Master of Ceremonies in Cabaret, Noel Coward's Design for Living in a one-man adaptation of Macbeth. Film roles include his performances in Emma, GoldenEye, The Spy Kids trilogy, X2, X-Men United, Romeo and Michelle's High School Reunion, Spice World, and Titus. Television projects include, but are very much not limited to, The Good Wife and a recent personal favorite, Apple TV's Schmigadoon, on which he portrays Mayor Aloysius Menlove. He's the author of two children's books, a book of photographs and stories, a novel, and the number one New York Times bestselling memoir, Not My Father's Son. He's a podcast entitled Shelves and a bar in New York City called Club Cumming. Alan Cumming, welcome to the Roundtable.
Thank you. Gosh, I'm exhausted just listening to everything I've done.
That is kind of what I was thinking. As I read your book, you specifically write in your book about times in your busy professional life and personal life where you've been in five countries in as many days. How do you think you've come to survive this schedule that you've had for yourself?
I mean, a combination of things. Good genes probably are chief amongst them.
Sure.
Hydrating constantly. But also just sort of, I think I remain curious and, open to the world. And so I think I roll with the punches. And I actually really like my life. I like what I do. And if I don't, I think I'm old enough and wise enough now to change things. So, there are times I think, I'm traveling too much or this is too overwhelming. I mean, I'm a little overwhelmed right now, actually, because, I thought there'd be a gradual, we'd get back into the way things were before the pandemic in terms of work. But no, it's gone from 0 to 60 in kind of 4 seconds. And then it's a lot right now. But I guess that's just not being used to it.
You must have, like we all did, got used to a slower pace for a bit there.
Yes, and I loved it, I have to say. I really, it sounds awful to say, but I really had a great experience during the pandemic in terms of, like, the amount of time I got to self-reflect and, spend upstate in the Catskills with my husband and just to also just really think a bit more. I mean, in a way, finishing off this book was a big part of what I did, but it also made me think, well, what do I really want to do? I thought I needed to do all the things that I'm not able to do now, and I seem to be quite happy without them. So it made me reassess quite a lot, actually.
And then it still blew open when the doors opened and you were allowed to go back out. You're still quite busy now.
Yes, well, unfortunately, you have to sort of, if you write a book, you have to basically, especially if it's a book about yourself, you have to pretty well promote it, be the person who promotes it.
Of course. Your previous memoir, Not My Father's Son, was published in 2014. You Gotta Get Bigger Dreams in 2016. How did you decide it was time to write and release Baggage now and delve into those years of your life and tell everybody who purchases and reads the book about yourself in these years?
For a variety of reasons. Writing Not My Father's Son was a huge thing for me. Obviously, I mean, the subject matter is very personal, very intimate about child abuse. And, it's a big thing to share. Mm-hmm. But I realized I couldn't not share it. I felt it was just overwhelming me. I found out all these crazy things. And I wanted to just, in some way, remove them from myself and put them into the world so that other people could see and hear about it. And I felt that would make me somehow cleansed of it or be able to easier to deal with. And it was. But at the same time, what actually happened was that me doing that inspired a lot of people. And I realized that it was my duty to do that, to be someone who has a platform to talk about all that kind of trauma. I had no idea how many people it would affect in a positive way to help them deal with their trauma. And so I realized that I want to keep, my writing just about me and myself and my feelings and my experience and living a life that is always in the shadow or always has a shadow of trauma. across it and how you maneuver that and how you manage that. I felt it was, I should sort of show people the next stage of my life and how I also felt that a lot of people were saying, oh, Alan has conquered, Alan has triumphed, Alan has overcome his past. And I feel I haven't. And I feel that's the wrong way to think about it. I feel the moment you try and pretend something hasn't happened or that you're over something, then you're lost because it's always going to be there and you just should get better at dealing with it. So that's what I guess this book is me saying to the world, look, I made loads of more mistakes. I am still a hot mess in many ways.
Well, or just, a person.
I feel, yeah, just a person. Yeah, and that's the thing. And I'm not going to pretend otherwise. You know, that's the biggest thing. I write in the book, I don't want you to buy into the Hollywood ending about everything. And then, of course, I proceed to tell you lots about my Hollywood life.
Well, Hollywood, you exactly put it this way. Hollywood calls throughout your career kind of when you need it or when you need a change. It seems to rescue you.
Yes.
And that must be odd as you realize that is what happened when you look back on the filming schedule of your years.
It was. It was one of the things in the book that was a surprise to me to see. And that's why I kind of made it a sort of feature. And it was, I was like, oh, my God, it happened again. You know, when I looked back, I thought, oh, that's right. I was having this terrible time. And then someone asked me to go, go off to Italy or something and make a film. So it was just really interesting how I was taken out of experiences by work, by Hollywood. And what's the great thing about making films is that you usually go away into very sort of contained, insular experiences that you're with a small, becoming quite a large group of people, but you probably are, staying in a hotel, working long hours. It actually is a very good thing to kind of focus and nourish yourself, even though you're working very hard. I mean, also equally, it can be very lonely and you can be away from those you love, but there's been times for me that it was really good to have that sort of, monk-like experience. Because I think the thing is, you see movie stars at the Oscars and their gowns and their jewels and gorgeous. But actually, for most of the time, they're wearing, big woolly coats and they're freezing in the middle of some mountain with crazy costumes and, funny teeth on. So it's actually a very deceitful presentation of a career, as well as it being a sort of deceitful content of a career.
With everything that you do and that you take on, when you are working on a book like the memoir Baggage that we're discussing right now, what is your writing regimen? Is it very strict or is it catch as catch can?
It used to change. It used to be, because I'd always be doing it whilst doing something else.
Of course.
Because, writing has never, even when I've written scripts or, other books, I've always done it whilst doing other things, films or TV or stuff. So I'm going this week or these weeks or these days just to write. But I was never able to do it in the way that I was able to last year, where every day I wrote, every single day. I actually so enjoyed that. I really enjoyed the sort of whole, again, sort of monk-like thing of it. I got a treehouse. I'd had a treehouse built in my place in the Catskills, and I would go to the treehouse and write. And it has electricity now, but it didn't have electricity then. And so I would wait until I would write until my battery on my computer went low, and I had to go inside. And it didn't have any phone signal there, so it was very sort of a really good place to write. But I actually really enjoyed the regularity of it. And also there's that thing. Some days I wouldn't write anything. I would just, go on the internet and Google myself and do all that. And I actually think, I actually realise how that's still writing. If you're at your desk, if you've made a commitment to go to that place, even if things aren't happening, you're still thinking, you're getting there. I think the writer, and I don't believe in just that thing where people say, oh, just write anything, as long as you write something. I think that's a load of rubbish. Because then you've got to edit a load of bad writing. I'd rather wait until the good writing comes up. I'd rather keep it in my head until it's ready to come out.
One quick question about the treehouse. What is the furniture setup? How are you positioned as you write in your, which sounds like just a magical spot?
I'm in a little corner. So it's a little house on stilts in the trees, and there's a little stair that goes up, and there's a little bed. So I can go for a lie down if I'm feeling exhausted by my literary output. And it's also where I read books. It's where I put all the books that I wanted to read but haven't got to yet. in a big bookcase. And so I have a little hanging, you know, one of those chairs that hangs on a little basket chair that hangs down. I sit in that and read. And then in the a little table in the corner, so I can look out the window into the trees. But that's where I sit and write. It's very Spartan, but cute.
Yeah, it sounds incredibly. And I said I had one question about the treehouse, but I have one more. Is your dog able to go up there or no?
Yes, it's because it's got proper steps up to it.
Ah, lovely.
So Lala, Jerry, my other dog, he can't do stairs, but Lala comes. She's got a little basket. But then there's a little ladder goes up to the bed, and she doesn't really like. We've slept together there once, but she's very scared because she can't go down the stairs herself because it's a ladder. Mm-hmm. So she sort of I dig it up and she went into the farthest corner of the bed, of the little loft bed. You know, the farthest corner, the safest bit.
Right.
That she could, and I kind of like cuddled around her. But yeah, no, she stays downstairs now when I go for a nap.
Yeah, doesn't seem like it's her favorite place.
No.
Another question about the Googling yourself, you said. You are, of course, then researching the subject of your book. That is the work that you're doing. And there's so much, because you've lived a life in the public eye, you've attended countless premieres, there is a lot to find about yourself online, and I imagine some of it isn't true or could be hurtful. How do you navigate that when you come across it in your research?
I think it's been long enough that I've had to encounter all that stuff. I mean, every day is potentially that, you know?
Yeah.
Especially right now when I'm doing loads of press. Every day there's new things coming out about the book and me and everything like that. And then, you know, there'll be an interview and someone will take something from that interview. Like the Sun newspaper last week talked about me wanting to do heroin. Made it sound like I was, you know, about to start taking heroin. When actually I'd said that if I live until I'm 80, I think I'd like to try heroin. So I think if I make it to 80, you know, it's not that I'm going to become a heroin addict. I'm not going to come. And I don't want to sort of be personal. If I get to 80, I think, oh, for goodness sakes, do some heroin, see what it's like.
Mm-hmm. And you might not. You might get there and decide, you know what, no.
I might not, yeah. So, but I'm not, I'm actually saying I'm not going to do heroin until, and maybe until I'm 80. And then it becomes Alan is doing heroin. So, you know, what can you do? But I think I've spent, you know, actually when I was younger, I was much more of a sort of tabloid fodder in Britain, especially. That's really the way, you know, people going through your trash and shouting up the letterbox to you and trying to interview your neighbours and things. But so I've had all that. I've had all that sort of awful scrutiny. And I think the worst that could possibly happen has happened in that area, really affecting my family. And actually was part of the reason that my father, and as I mentioned in my first book, told me that I was not his biological son. That was actually because of something about to do with the press as well. Mm-hmm. So I actually think it's all right. I feel quite, you know, thick-skinned about it. But the thing that's interesting about looking at, you know, if you go to sort of photo agency websites and go to like premieres and stuff like that, it's so hilarious. You see yourself in photographs and people that you just think, oh my God, I met Drew Barrymore in 1995. Who knew? Things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm always amazed that when you see pictures in magazines and it's you with someone and you don't even remember that you were there and also the clothes are probably clothes that you had to give back the next day. So the whole thing's very, and this person you're sort of smiling next to like you've known them forever is probably someone you literally are being introduced to as you're smiling. They're actually talking like this while you're smiling. And so those sorts of things are very amusing to me. I think it's that sort of transient, ephemeral kind of nature of showbiz is sort of, you know, hilarious. Again, very deceitful because it's not always accurate to what was going on.
You mentioned in the book that you like being photographed, especially with a, you know, a good professional photographer who is having a good give and take, a true artist who's there listening to you and responding to you and giving you suggestions. Mm. How did you find that was a part of the career that you liked?
Well, I guess it's because you have to do it so much. I mean, in a way, it's sort of acting. Obviously just standing there and smiling, you know, anyone can do that and it's sort of, that's a little boring. But when you work with a photographer that's kind of got an idea about how to represent you, it's more like being a character rather than just being yourself. And I like that better. And I'm sort of, you know, I think it's, unless it's just a portrait of you a very simple portrait, then I think actually it's more interesting to me to act and pretend and, you know, play with a look and with clothes and everything like that. That I really enjoy that. I think it's fun. It's like dress up. And I'd rather do that than just sort of stand there smiling. And, you know, because I'm not a model. Although I do, you know, I have done a bit of modelling in my time, actually.
Of course.
I was once a Lee Jeans model for a TV commercial in America years ago. And when I first came to New York, I modelled. I was a Tommy Hilfiger model for a brief moment. It's bizarre now when you think about it. I mean, you know, I've done a lot of weird things in my life.
You mentioned that in releasing the books, people who read them, you know, come to you, come to your events and discuss with you or thank you for sharing your stories so that it helps them to cope with or see or verbalize their trauma. Do people ever act like they know you? Are people ever over familiar with you? And do you have a way to handle that if it happens?
Yes, is the answer. And there are various ways. Well, sometimes you have security people with you. You know, when I do play shows on Broadway, I usually have a person who comes and picks me up from work. And like, so it's a driver. His name's Carmine, but he also is sort of a security person to make sure that you can get in and out. You know, because with a play, people know where you are.
Right.
You know, you have to arrive and leave from the same door. So, and people, you know, you just have to be careful sometimes. And also, you've got to try and get to work. You don't have time always to hang around and say hello to people. But mostly, I think I'm very good at... I have quite rigid kind of guidelines about... Like last night, I was in Club Cumming at my bar. And I just... Some people asked for a photo, and I said, no, I'm not going to take a photo with you, because if I take a photo with you, everyone will see and everybody will want a photo, and my whole night will just become about taking a photograph. So I just don't take photos of people. And as soon as you say that and you're just kind and you explain it, and you explain it why, and you say, I'm just here relaxing, I'm not at work, it's nice to meet you, but, you know, or if I sometimes I'll take a photo outside so that everybody doesn't see. And I just think things like that, when you have to have, you know, you have to remember that it's your choice to... Like in life, it's all our own personal choice to engage with someone else. And obviously, if you're at a premiere, if you're, you know, in some sort of thing where you're doing a sort of promotional thing, then yeah, it's really appropriate to be engaging and open to people who come up to you. But when you're just going through your life, I think you have to make your own boundaries about what you feel is acceptable. So I'm always very kind, and I do a thing of, you know, constantly moving. Mm-hmm. You just have to keep, because actually that's what's great about Carmine. When you have Carmine, he kind of puts his hand in the small of my back and kind of propels me forward. In this sort of, you know, you can sort of go, oh, bye, oh, sorry, I can't stop. And so I kind of try and do that in my life. People say hello to me, and I go, hello. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they say, can I have a photo? I'm like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm in a rush. Nice to meet you, though, you know. And kind of, you just sort of try and keep moving. And also just, I think, try and be kind at all times, because, you know, people are sometimes a little rude. They're a little overwhelmed to meet you sometimes, and you have to remember they're probably not always like that. They're just kind of slightly, even sometimes they're shaking, you know, because they've seen someone famous. And so you have to sort of, you have to guide them a little bit.
Because the understanding that they're overwhelmed because they're meeting someone famous. Have you ever been, and I think you have from some stories in the book, overwhelmed meeting a celebrity who came before you?
Yes, I've done a few. I've had a few fangirl moments. I mean, my biggest one ever is Christopher Guest. Mm-hmm. I just think he's a genius. I'm actually looking at a photograph of him and me and my husband right now on my wall in my shelves. And but when I first met him, I was just a mess. and then I made him laugh. It was at a dinner. I was seated with him at a dinner, and I made him laugh. And it was like my greatest artistic achievement ever, to make Christopher Guest laugh. And then the other person I did it with is that lovely Irish actor who was in Bridesmaids. You know, the guy, Chris O'Dowd.
Yes, Chris O'Dowd.
I just thought, I adore him. I think he's brilliant. And I ran into him unexpectedly at this party. I'd had a few drinks. And he was like quite sort of like, oh, look, it's Alan Cumming. And I was like, oh, my God, I just love you. And I just went on and on and on. And I could tell he sort of looked scared. and you know that thing when you, I know, because people do it to me, that you can't stop. You think, I know I should stop talking now because it's getting, and then you just can't, and you sort of make it worse and worse and worse. it was just it was a mess. And I've never really seen him since, actually. And of course, I'll go the next time I see him, I want to go over and say, I'm so sorry about that time that I freaked out. And of course, he'll be like, oh my God, he's here again. He's doing it again. So, but those are, I mean, it's sort of weird, worky. I meet people who are much more sort of, you know, mainstream, mega famous than those two, but I sort of seem to be fine with them. It's more just like kind of work crushes that I just go a bit googly.
You are doing a cabaret called Achen Oi, a considered cabaret with NPR's Ari Shapiro. How did you guys meet up and decide to do this?
Well, Ari interviewed me a couple of times. I met him through a mutual friend. And then he kind of, you know, I had a book out and he did an evening with, you know, kind of thing. And then there's another thing at the Stonewall anniversary. I did a thing in Washington at the museum and he interviewed with that. And so we were friends and did that for a few times. And actually, after the last time, I said to him, you know, we have such a good rapport, Ari. And I really like the fact that when you get interviewed by someone and those sort of book things, you know, that you're selling your book and it's fun, but you don't expect to be challenged. You don't expect to be. So I really liked the fact that Ari was. He did. It wasn't a fluff piece he was doing. He kind of came back at me about a couple of things and challenged me on things, and I was like, oh, interesting. And I really liked that. And also, he's hilarious. And also, I said to him, we've got a really good rapport. We get on well. And I'd sung a song with him at Joe's Pub in New York when he'd done a solo. He sings, you know, with Pink Martini, that band.
Yes.
So I just suggested it would be a good idea. And he went, don't joke with me about things like that, Alan. So if you only say it if you mean it, because I'd love to. And I went, oh, I mean it. So the next morning, I started to call him up. And it's like kind of, I still respect you in the morning kind of call. I'd sort of say to him, I still mean it, Ari. I still would like to. So we started it. And it's just fun because, you know, we're sort of very, I think our images that people have of us are very different. Ari's the sort of buttoned up NPR person. I'm like the sort of messy little mischievous Scottish person. And so I think we're a good combo. And actually, of course, what the show shows you is that we're much more alike than you might imagine.
We are just about out of time, but I have to, if not ask a question about Schmigadoon, at least tell you that I love it. So thank you for making it.
Thank you. I adore it. And I am. So clever. And it was actually my first job, you know, back.
Was it?
I made it during the pandemic, actually, like a year ago, September of 2020. But no, it was a really magical thing. And I hope we're going to do a second one.
I really hope so, too. It's so for musical people, and it's so sort of subversive and sends up all of the tropes. And it's just fantastic, yeah. And you're fantastic in it.
Alan, thanks.
Of course. Alan Cumming will be in conversation with Joe Donahue at the Bardavon Opera House in Poughkeepsie, New York on Monday, October 25th. His new memoir, Baggage, is published by Day Street Books. Alan Cumming, I'm an enormous fan of your work, and I thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. This is really fun.
Once again, Alan Cumming will be in conversation with Joe Donahue at the Bardavon in Poughkeepsie, New York, Monday, October 25th. Bardavon.org for more information. I'm Sarah LaDuke, and you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.